Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Freakonomics Radio recently kicked off its third season here on WNYC, investigating a range of topics from locavorism to how to break bad habits, all the while finding those weird, unexpected connections that make you go, huh. Stephen J. Dubner is the co-author of the books Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics, as well as the host of the program. He joins us now to discuss this week's episode and to give us a little preview of what the season has in store. Stephen, thanks for being here, right here in the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me. I should note that you're smiling, which is people on the radio can't see, but it's good to see you here.
I'm a big Freakonomics fan. This is very exciting
well,
for me.
Yeah, it's fun to be on the radio. So yeah.
Exactly. So, Stephen, some of the features you can sum up in just a few words. For example, part of this week's episode deals with weird recycling, and we'll hear more on that in a bit. But this week, you also look at the idea that knowledge is not power. In other words, what we know doesn't always factor into what we end up believing. Isn't that getting a little metaphysical by Freakonomics standards?
It is, and it's also not material that's typically best suited to journalism or radio. It's really something that you kind of typically want a book for. But we kind of picked some narrow pieces of this, and basically to reduce it to the most reducible, you would say that empirically, and you know, Freakonomics is really trying to measure things, trying to come to conclusions about the way the world works, not based on ideology or dogma or opinion or emotion, which is what we all do as humans, but rather to try to find some data. And so this is an area where some people have been working with data to try to figure out what makes people believe what they do. And to make a very long story very short, it turns out that on hot button issues, whether it's climate change and how people feel about that, nuclear power, gun control, abortion, any of these kind of what have become litmus test issues, hot button issues that incorporate a lot of facts, it turns out you would think that the more you know about a topic, the more likely you would be to be in concert with others who know a lot and to kind of come down on the right side of things. Turns out that's not the case. Turns out that people who are very educated about a given topic tend to hold the most extreme views on it. Again, so climate change is one that caught our attention. It turned out that people who know a lot of science don't tend to have a consensus view about the threat of global warming. It turns out that they occupy the extremes. Why? Because smart people are really good at reading a lot of confirmatory evidence of what they already believe. So that's really the bottom line here, is we are pretty good at knowing what we believe already and then trying to confirm that rather than trying to find something new.
Right. So this explains a lot of Thanksgiving dinner fights, does it not?
Oh, my goodness. That wound is still too fresh. We had 31 people, and my kids, who were kind of among the youngest of the crowd, we strictly informed them that these are the topics that we will not talk about at Thanksgiving. And it worked pretty much for the most part, except, interestingly enough, we had an open mic comedy night during Thanksgiving that my son Solomon decided he wanted to do, and he emceed. And it was during the jokes that all the biases came out. Mm. But, you know, when they're couched in joke form, they're a lot more palatable.
Yeah, jokes are a form of diplomacy, definitely. So let me share this clip with you. Dr. Ellen Peters, a research scientist at Ohio State, who studies how our general level of knowledge impacts our ideology. She explains what she's observed about that link.
People who are highly numerate and highly scientifically literate, they seem to actually rely on pre-existing beliefs, on these sort of underlying cultural cognitions they have about how the world should be structured, more than people who are less scientifically literate or less numerate.
So if I wanted to be wildly reductive, I might say that the more education a culture gets, the more likely we are to have intense polarization, at least among the educated classes. Is that right?
Based on our data, that's what it looks like. It's so interesting and so disturbing at the same time.
So what do you think of that? It seems that that goes to the point that you're making about confirmation bias.
I'll be honest with you. As she said, it's, you know, interesting and disturbing. I also find it quite comforting because I think it explains a lot. I think it explains a lot of why not even – I was going to say relatively smart people why smart people can have such incredibly legitimate differences with other smart people. It's because, you know, there's a beautiful phrase that the psychologist Danny Kahneman, who's known as kind of the founder of behavioral economics, even though he's a psychologist, there's a phrase he uses called we are blind to our blindness. Mm-hmm. We are very good, many of us, at seeing the biases in other people. In ourselves, however, what are you talking about? I have no bias. I don't have my thumb on the scale in any direction. But we do have these dogmas, these beliefs that we continue to feed with confirmatory evidence while continuing to devalue the holdings, the beliefs of other people. So it'd be nice if it weren't so, but knowing that it is so, to me, makes the world a little bit more comprehensible, in fact.
Right. I call this the beautiful and unique snowflake syndrome, where we all think we're too
Indeed.
Pure. And I was actually interested in the practical implications of what you're talking about. I mean, so can we learn to debate better? Can we learn to control our biases when we're talking about these, whether we're educated or not about a subject?
You know, that is a great question. We're actually – so my Freakonomics co-author, Steve Levitt, and I, we're working on a new book that's different than what we've done in the past. And it's really about kind of applying what we've learned in these case studies to kind of making your way through the world. And one of the first steps in thinking through a problem, if you're trying to fix a world – and look, face it, we're all trying to fix or improve the world in some way, whether it's just within your family, the government, society, or whatnot. You know, the first step, we argue, is you have to know what's actually going on rather than what you believe dearly you want to happen or what you desperately hope doesn't happen. So our argument is that we've all got a strong moral compass, but the first thing you want to do is put it away. Put the moral compass away until you can use some facts, some data to determine what's actually going on. Then you can whip that compass back out and say, okay, now I know what's happening and this is what I want to happen, but at least I'll be operating from a position of fact rather than dogma.
Right. So this would put MSNBC and Fox out of business, would it not?
Look, you know, entertainment is entertainment, whether it's political, sports, you know. Nobody's making the argument that ESPN should be out of business because it favors American football over, you know, the NHL. The NHL gets short shrift on ESPN. Does that mean they shouldn't be allowed? No, absolutely. So nobody here is arguing for a, quote, level playing field in how we believe what we believe. But when you're talking about topics that matter, that policy is being written on, it'd be nice if we could get the dogma out of the room.
Right. So do we isolate ourselves then from people who disagree? I've read all these studies about how people who watch Fox won't watch the quote unquote liberal press.
Yeah. In fact, it's interesting. In this episode that's airing this week on WNYC, it's called I think it's called The Truth Is Out There is the name of this episode. And it is about this group, the Cultural Cognition Project, who explores why people believe what they do and how they come to believe that. And one fellow there, Dan Kahan, who's a scholar at Yale, makes a very interesting point that, in fact, a big part of how we choose to embrace a particular belief, whether it's about climate, whether it's about a social issue, has to do simply with the cohort, the people we hang out with, family and friends. So if I teach at Yale like he does, it becomes very difficult for me to hold alternative views, even if just in a social setting. Now, you may say, well, who cares about that? But the fact is that that actually cares more to an individual than what my belief as an individual – it will move the needle more for me as an individual than it will for me as an individual trying to impact society, whether I care or not about global warming. And so his argument is that unbeknownst to most of us, we do hurt ourselves quite ably. There's a little bit of border collie in all of us, I'm afraid.
I think that's an image we'll all have to live with. So listeners, have you ever found your knowledge and your beliefs out of juncture? How do you reconcile that? Or how do you go to find information that's contrary to what you believe? Call us up at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So Stephen, I have another clip for you. This is Mr. Skeptic, Michael Shermer. He explains that there's an evolutionary basis for conspiracy theorists. Here he is.
So my thought experiment is, imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago. Your name is Lucy. And you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator or is it just the wind? Well, if you think that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error in cognition, a false positive. You thought A was connected to B, but it wasn't. But no big deal. That's a low-cost error to make. You just become a little more cautious and vigilant, but that's it. On the other hand, if you think the rustle in the grass is just the wind and it turns out it's a dangerous predator, your lunch. Congratulations, you've just been given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool before reproducing. So we are the descendants of those who were most likely to find patterns that are real. In other words, we tend to just believe all Russells in the grass are dangerous predators, just in case they are. And so that's the basis of superstition and magical thinking.
So these are the people who go the other way around and derive their knowledge from their beliefs. What did you find about conspiracy theorists?
Well, they're an interesting sort. You know, here's the thing. There's a phrase that academics use, kind of ironically, but it's real. It's called update your priors, prior meaning prior beliefs. So I think I'm going to have to update my priors on that, they'll say.
Sounds criminal.
Well, no, it's actually a fantastic thing. It means I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and I've established a fact-based belief on, but based on this new evidence you're giving me, I've got to update my priors. It's like the ultimate admission of really humility and intellectual honesty, you know? I think we all need to update our priors constantly for part of the reason what Michael Shermer said there, which is that, you know, I love human beings. I think we're a fantastic animal capable of many great things, some terrible things, huge accomplishments, but there is a degree to which we are quite ancient hardware trying to run a lot of really modern software. Mm. And there are conflicts there. So like Michael Shermer just described, do we still hear that rustle in the grass and assume it's potentially fatal? A lot of us do that in all different kinds of versions. It's kind of the difference between what you'd call risk and uncertainty. Risk you can measure, uncertainty you can't. It's also, you know, we should try, all of us, to distinguish between cheap false positives and expensive false positives. In other words, if the bad thing happens, is it a big deal? If not, no, then let's not be so scared about it and throw so many resources at it. But we don't think like that. So this radio hour, this, you know, Truth is Out There radio hour is kind of meant to give people a little bit of ammunition for trying to update our priors, to think their way through the world a little bit more, I think, I would argue, profitably for all of us. I don't mean profitably money. I mean, you know, better. We could make society a little bit better by thinking a little bit more cogently.
Well, we have a caller on this. Let's go to Ryan from Rutherford, New Jersey. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Do you have a question for Stephen?
Not so much a question. I just wanted to say that I think Benjamin Franklin got the jump on you guys a little bit some time ago, and it's not a verbatim quote, but he once said something to the gist of, it's a great thing to be rational man because we can find rationalization for whatever it is we like.
That is a great quote. It's I guess the flip side of it would be, it's a great thing to be a rational person. On the other hand, you might not have a lot of company at the dinner table. I mean, that's kind of right. That's kind of the downside of it is, you know, I find that if you make arguments based on real rational, what we all say we embrace rational thought, but at the end of the day, now, I was looking the other day for this book we're working on now, a long list of things that economists talk about and kind of believe in that have nothing to do with the economy. A lot of the things are about the value of life and so on. And many things that a lot of rational thinkers like an economist will think about are absolutely not allowed in polite company. It's just we've kind of got a mode of conversation that allows some kind of thoughts and others. So rationality is fantastic if you can get away with it in your circle. One circle where you can't get away with it a lot is politics. I mean, we see that every day. I firmly believe that most of the folks who go to Washington have the very best intentions to enact legislation that profits the most of us in the best way possible. And then, as it turns out, the rules change there, and that's what we're up against.
Right. So let's actually talk a little bit about the beginning of your episode, which is weird recycling, including using nuclear waste as a power source. Talk about a polarizing issue. Can you tell us really quickly in about a minute what that's all about?
So this episode, yeah, it's weird recycling is this part of the episode. It's about three things that we like: medical waste, nuclear waste, and chicken feet. So these are three examples of things that would seem to have very little value, maybe even negative value. And the nuclear waste, there's actually a movement afoot to create a new kind of nuclear reactor that would use depleted uranium, as a fuel for a new source.
That's really interesting. And I look forward to listening to more of Freakonomics. Stephen J. Dubner is the host of Freakonomics Radio, which airs at 8 p.m. Wednesdays and 4 p.m. Saturdays on WNYC 93.9 FM. You can also catch it on AM 820 at 2 p.m. Saturday and 8 p.m. Sunday, when it's also on New Jersey Public Radio. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Heidi.